Great. Hi, everyone. My name is Andrew. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Andrew.
Thanks, Karen, for the opportunity to share. It wasn't too long ago that I shared here, but I think a lot of members were at in Toronto at the convention when I last shared here. And my sobriety date is March the 10th, 2003. I came into these rooms a wreck. I was on a slippery slope to hell, essentially. My home group's AA for All on Sunday nights. And I remember coming in there 2.5 years ago on 2 hours sleep. I was stoned. I'd been up all night. I got beaten up by the police for being rather lippy in a blackout. And I actually got beaten up a number of times that night. So my back was hurting. Like I said, I had 2 hours sleep. I was stoned. The speaker, the A for All's for the dually addicted. So the speaker was speaking mostly on cocaine use. And I couldn't remember a word she said. All I remember is the topic was, how does God speak to you? To me, it was obvious. I had no intention of coming into AA at the time. I was in complete and utter denial for years. You know, everybody, it's the old story, everybody else knew I had a problem except for me. And so I guess I'll start off by saying that I came from a rather large family, four brothers, four sisters. Most of them are either in the rooms or need to be in the rooms. I lost a brother to alcoholism and drugs. It seemed to accelerate my drinking at one point. But getting back to where it started, I grew up in a nice suburb just north on the other side of the mountain. And everything looked great from the outside looking in. We had everything, certainly everything we needed. And and I know I had all the isms right from the get-go, you know. My mom, always include this in my share, that my mom always said that she was an only child and she always wanted to have a lot of kids so we wouldn't feel lonely. Leave it to an alcoholic to feel lonely in a family of nine, you know. Like, how does that happen, you know, but it did. So I guess I have had and have all the isms that we all hear about. You know, didn't quite feel like part of, that sort of thing, you know. So I took to drinking and drugging at an early age. I had my first drink when I was 12. First sip of beer when I was 10, but I spit that out on the lawn. I think if I'd have felt the effect, I probably would have gotten into it right away. My first drugs when I was 13. You know, I hear often people say, well, this is AA, and what the hell, this is also 2005, and there's not too many people in this room that it's not part of their story. I mean, and I do respect the fact that it is AA, but in this, the world I grew up in, we were smoking drugs. I smoked drugs when I was 13. I did my first hit of acid when I was 13. Mescaline, you name it. And basically, it's all about running away from ourselves, you know. And I just didn't feel comfortable in my own skin and didn't really know why. And that's what it was all about, you know. My drinking and drugging career spanned over 30 years. Believe me, I earned my spot, my seat in the rooms. you know, probably spend a little less time tonight qualifying, having spent some time in the rooms and wanting to speak about other things as well, like a little bit about recovery and what this program's done for me, you know. And so I went through high school. I wasn't what you would call an academic. I got tossed out of a school just down the street that charges a lot of money to get in. I didn't last there very long. I just wasn't an academic, you know. And I started working full-time at a very early age. After high school, I headed out west, did a lot of partying and dance. Alberta. I'm sure there's still people I know that are still there. You know, it was we're normal custom to fill the table with draft on a Friday, Thursday, or Monday night, you know. And I just remember it even like in high school, you know, like going out and, I mean, I used to deal drugs. I remember leaving Tanmount Royal High School at lunch hour and with my friend Dave and my business partner at the time. And we'd have a couple of tall ones and then go back to school, you know, and think nothing of it. He was funny, too, because he used to eat a club sandwich and smoke at the same time. He'd take a bite of his club sandwich, take a puff of his cigarette, and that's the way it went. My friend Dave's no longer with us, you know. He hit a curb at 110 kilometers an hour. And coming home from a bar, you know, I've lost a number of friends due to drugs and alcohol. And one of my brothers, you know, so I had a lot of wake-up calls, you know, and even my own experience. It's amazing how much we can be in denial, you know. And so I came back from Western Canada, my early 20s. I've always been really lucky in terms of, you know, just my life, jobs I've gotten. I don't have a university education, but I've had some pretty good jobs throughout my life. Growing up as a kid, like I said, wasn't hurting for anything. We go to Nova Scotia every summer. We had a summer house on the ocean there from St. John Baptiste to Labor Day every year. You know, it's a pretty good life. And boy, did we ever party in the Maritimes, you know, in the summers. You know, like I remember one time going to a party on an island, and I think I was 14 years old. And there's like certain liquor I wouldn't drink after a while because from bad experiences, you know, and that was one of them. I think everybody was, there was about 60 of us that converged on this island for an overnight party, and I didn't make it to sundown, you know, and I think I drank 26 ounces of scotch before sundown, and I passed out in an anthill. Woke up the next morning, the sun had risen, and covered in. I come to and I just lick little pinches, you know. And I come to and I just dove in the ocean, you know, because get these red army ants off my body, you know. So I missed the whole party, you know. So I'm sure there's a few people in this room that can relate to that. So getting back from out west, I got a really great job when I was 24 years of age. One that enabled me to travel all around North America, Hawaii a couple of times, Berlin, London, you know, and give a 24-year-old kid a job for 8 years where he gets to travel around on expense, and not all the time. Like, I just, I had a very unique position, you know. I was able to, I would show up at this mansion in a baseball cap and sweatpants, and somehow this was my job, you know, and then I would get to travel, you know, and there was a restaurant in this mansion where I could go downstairs and sign for my meals, and it was really, I'll spare you the details, but I met my wife, my ex-wife, and around the same time as I got this job, about a year into it, and you know, we ended up buying a condo, and I eventually bought my family's summer home through this this marriage, and it was like a period of travel, you know, the old story, wine, women, and drugs. And the only thing is, I was married at the time, so you're not supposed to have the women part in your story, but it's like anything else, you know, I learned everything the hard way, you know. And what I know now is that I can't have a relationship with someone and not be monogamous, but I had to really learn the hard way, you know. It was ridiculous, actually. And so it was like 8 or 9 years of a lot of travel, a lot of drinking, more and more and more, like you wouldn't believe. I look back on it, and I don't know, it was like right out of a movie. the things that would come up. And, you know, when you're a real alcoholic, it's like I bought this summer home from my family. It had 11 bedrooms. And, you know, it's 8 feet from a cliff. And it's weighs 60 tons. And I get in my head, I'm going to move this house off the edge of a cliff, you know. And two stories, you know, with it. Anyways. So ended up doing just that. You know, my kid brother shaved his head and cleared an acre and a half of land. And we got stoned and we figured out where we were going to put the house. Today it sits on partly on a neighbor's property, but I'm not telling anyone, you know. it was a real trip. So, you know, things would just go on. I got offered at the end of this job when I was in my early 30s, after 8 years, 9 years of working this other job, which I left, you know, feeling like I'd accomplished what I needed to accomplish. Anyways, someone offered me a job in New York City, so I took that and moved to, loaded up the truck and didn't move to Beverly Hills, but I moved to New York City. And that was a whole trip, too. And, you know, the drinking, if they say, it doesn't get any, I don't know if you say better or worse, or well, put it this way, it accelerated when I moved to New York City. Just prior to moving there, my kid brother, who was the best man at my wedding and whatnot, ended up jumping off a building. 15-story building, you know, after he did his four steps. So the idea of coming into AAA, like, was not an exciting proposition for me, you know. And really, I don't attribute it to the four step. Today, when I look back on it, it was a coincidence. And in the sense that he was doing it, and I think if he'd have gotten into his fifth, and that's the whole thing about loosening the load and getting the... you know, getting that weight off your shoulders, you know, and somehow he had some serious emotional problems and psychological problems, so he couldn't hang in there, and who knows, maybe he's in a better place, I don't know, but one thing I do know, for some of us that are left behind, it's like, that's when my drinking really accelerated. I was a little, you know, burying your kid brother, I was tougher on my mom, you know, and whatnot, but it definitely accelerated my drinking. But see, I'm not looking for excuses or poor me, or the program's taught me that self-pity and resentment are not where it's at, you know, for alcoholics. And, you know, even when I look back at my childhood, you know, and some of the things, you know, my parents did or didn't do or whatever, all that's academic to me, you know, because I've been taught to kind of look at my side of the street in my life now, you know, and it's interesting, it's all just a journey, you know, and that's the way I see it. And so I was in New York, again, I had a great job, I got offered an incredible job down there, working for a large restaurant, dinner and entertainment concept that had medieval overtones. It was like the Walt Disney of the restaurant business. And I used to always laugh at how I'd get these gigs, you know, like, it was really funny. And, you know, making six-figure kind of dollars, someone would move me to another country. And, you know, to me it was a joke, you know, because I was like on the sidelines. As soon as I left work, man, I was... went out for a drink, I'd be rolling a joint. It used to really tickle me that, you know, someone would actually, like, pay a guy like me money to do anything, you know. And but that's the way it went. And I ended up getting divorced in New York City in the Law and Order building, and represented myself, went up against one of New York's finest, and won. It's like, it's just a lark, eh, for an alcoholic. It's just a good time, you know. And I left my wife, and I went to Nova Scotia to, and I rented out my summer home to rich people, and ran a charter boat business for that summer. And I was just going to regroup and figure out what I wanted to be when I grew up. And little did I know I wouldn't start growing up till I came into the rooms a few years later, but that's another story. And I don't know, I that summer was like the summer of my life. You know, I had a son in the, he was 8 months old when I left New York, and I remember spending my first Father's Day away. So it was just like life can be full of paradoxes, and on the one hand, it was the summer of my life because I went and I ran a charter boat business. I had this like a mini lobster boat, and I ran dinner cruises, and I just had a very fertile imagination, and put some drugs in my system, and I'd really get the fertile imagination would get even more fertile, and just did some pretty wild things in terms of this little fishing village that just was not ready for a guy like me, and my antics, and in terms of promotions and whatnot, and what I did with his business, and you know, I think of what happened that summer, and that was really exemplified where my alcoholism had taken me—the good, bad, and the ugly too. Like there were a lot of fun times, and you know, for those of you who were here in July, I shared on a story where I nearly killed 9 people in a storm, and you know, just because I was irresponsible enough to take these people out. You know, when there were really heavy seas, and we got hit by a rogue wave, and I'm not going to get into that whole story now, but I shouldn't be here talking to you. You know, I remember I used to pray for God to save me from myself, because I could really see what was happening, and I said that prayer for a few years, and I really think that that's why I'm still around. You know, there was many incidents that summer where, you know, I'd be out on a dinner cruise, and these people would say, I'd be cruising along in the fog in the dark, and people would say, I remember this couple saying, how the hell do you know, just by curiosity, we know you don't have any radar or, you know, depth finders, or how the hell do you know where you are? You know, it's like pitch black, we're in the fog, I'm rolling along, you know, I've had a couple of drinks, and oh, I said, no problem, because the locals were very good to me, and they would show me little tricks of the trade, you know. So I said, well, you see that little sort of, it's like an aura, a white aura up in the sky. I said, that's the moon. I said, it's about 10 o'clock, so that means the town of Digby is over there, you know. And they said, okay, and I'm cruising along at almost full throttle, okay. And I was right, you know. The only thing is I had the direction right, but I wasn't where I was supposed to be. Okay, I was in a cove over. Digby was over there. I thought I was here, but I was really over here. So what that meant, I knew I wasn't too far from the shoreline. So all of a sudden, I'm cruising along full tilt, and I see all these wooden posts in front of, like right in front of me. So like I swerve, and what it was is that old gypsum plant, a wharf, you know, and it's like, if I'd have been like talking to them, and just, I would have plowed right into it, and that's why I really, my higher power's been around me a lot longer than when I was like, my whole life, you know, we'll put it that way, and, you know, hopefully I'll hear another speaker, you're like, no, keep coming back. So, like, this went on that whole summer, all these different episodes. I end up going back to New York. I settle up on my divorce. I come back to Montreal and in the mid-90s. And then my drinking really, my ex-wife wanted to come back here with our child, so I ended up coming back here. That's a whole other story in itself. But I'm a dedicated dad, you know, so I came back here just before the referendum, and probably the only idiot walking around the streets of Montreal with a green card for the U.S. just before the referendum. But it's the old story, you do things for the right reasons. I was here because of my child, came back, and as a result, I got really good work again, and very interesting opportunities came my way, and with these interesting opportunities came lots of more cash and a lot of more drinking, a lot more partying, and then these funny things called blackouts started creeping into my life. A new toy, because I didn't know really what they were, and you know, just like debauchery, you know, like I remember hitting a concrete wall at 120 miles an hour, or kilometers an hour. What difference does it make at that speed? And that brought me out of my blackout, you know. After my head had hit and I like cut and you know, it was too much. All these signs, and it's amazing the denial. Like when I look back on it now, it's like how I could deny. You know, maybe someday you'll see the movie. But the things that were going on in my life, it was just like there was no denying that I had a serious problem with alcohol and drugs, you know? And yet, like my father would say, he would say, you know what Andrew's problem is? He can handle it, you know? Like stay out and party till 4 in the morning, I'll be up with women, whatever, and be at work the next day. Well, even that was starting to, you know, I was starting to feel it and not always making it to work the next day and whatnot. So I told you a little about that last night. I think anybody who's going to make it in these rooms, there's two ingredients, willingness, and you got to be ready. And I really believe that on the 10th of March, 2003, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. The promises started kicking in before the ninth step. He gave me a little advance billing on that one because I had no intention of coming into the rooms. You know, I was beginning to see I had a serious problem because I was starting to get the shakes in the morning. And, you know, I hadn't gotten to the point where I needed a drink in the morning. And I used the word yet, you know. And what I remember when I first came into the rooms and I would hear a really low bottom drunk log or whatever. And I'd go, oh, well, that never happened to me. You know, I even asked this guy that knew me outside the rooms. I said, you know, and I was telling him that. I said, you know, I said, do you really think I'm an alcoholic? Oh, he says, no question, Andrew. He says, of all the people I've ever known out there, he said, you're in my top 10. I said, okay. You know, and so I guess I was meant to be here. But I came into the rooms, and I really think that God chopped me down like a big tree that night. I really do, in retrospect. And it was interesting, too, because the topic, like I said, was how does God speak to you? I'm in a church basement on a Sunday night. I think he has spoken, you know. And I went to the little break room. You could smoke at AA for all at the time. And I see this guy, and he says, you know, at the end of the meeting, they give away this little chip, you know. And that was the start of me just listening to whatever I was told to do, you know. And so I took the chip, you know. People were very nice to me. I lost my license for drinking and driving ultimately and twice. I mean, I'd been, my career, 25 different times I was face-to-face with police officers, totally drunk in all different parts of the world and always got off. It was unbelievable. But not these last two times, you know. And so I did what we always hear. And, you know, you've been around the rooms for a while, you always hear the same thing. You know, you got a sponsor, you know, start doing the steps, you know, join a home group, get active, get the hell out of my head. You know, I'm not going to sit here and explain why all these things. There's enough speakers that will tell you. You know, it just works. And like in the big book, you know, I love the way AA puts things, you know. It's like suggestions. And I like that term when someone says, well, yeah, if you're, like I'm an alcoholic, man, I can't drink. If I drink, I'm going to kill myself or I'm going to kill somebody else. You know, it's pure and simple. I'm on a slippery slope, you know. And they say, like, it's like when you jump out of an aircraft, they suggest to pull a parachute. Are you freaking kidding? They say, you know, if you don't, pardon my language, but you're fucked. You know, you're going to hit the ground like that. And that's the way I see it, the same way with this disease, you know. And I think beyond that, and I like the, when I heard someone stand up and say, well, my problem is computers earlier tonight, you know. Because that's what this is. This book is showing me how to live. And it doesn't matter what it is, that what my addiction is. That's why it's repeated in so many different different fellowships, you know. Okay, it's because it's a program for living. It shows people like us that have to fill the void, you know, with something, whether it's drugs, food, sex, you name it. Okay, we do these things because we are not comfortable within ourselves and we don't know how to live. And the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is showing me how to live. And it's showing me how to get comfortable with myself. And it's not, like it says in Vision for You, it's going to be revealed to me slowly. You know, and I just have to keep showing up. I did a 12-step workshop within 3 months of coming into AA. And that's another thing. People say, well, take it easy. Another year, do your steps. That's not the way it used to work in AA. You'd show up at a meeting, and they'd run you first through the first three steps the first night they met you. The next time you saw their sons of bitches, they'd be getting you to write your fourth. You know what I mean? And the success rate was a lot higher than it is today. You know? And so they were a little hardcore in those days. And they, again, you know, it says in How It Works, you know, rarely have we seen a person fail that thoroughly follows our path, you know? Well, really, it's never, you know? And half measures and stuff, I see it all the time. Because people who do the little suggestions and as hokey as all these the slogans seem at first, you know, it's the people that give them a chance and give themselves a chance long enough to know what these freaking slogans mean, okay? The guy like me who's 6 months sober, and I'm having anxiety attacks, and these people are driving me freaking nuts because they're saying, all is well. I mean, I have this meeting all the time. All is well. I'm thinking to myself, well, these people, shut up. What is this? You know? And really what it is because I have a perception problem. I'm looking at things like the world's falling apart when I really got a lot to be grateful for. And that if I can control my thinking first thing in the morning, okay, and understand that really all is well. And I remember once waking up and having serious anxiety and having nothing else to turn to and thinking, okay, well, I'm sarcastic. I'm in the shower and I'm going, I feel like shit, okay? And I'm going to work and I go, all is well, you know, all is well. And then I turn it into a Bob Marley tune in my head and I'm thinking, don't you worry about a thing. Because every little thing is going to be all right. And I start singing that song. And it totally took me out of this. You know, because this member, this old timer told me it's your thinking that leads to emotion. It's emotions that make you feel. So you feel like shit. It's your thinking that's screwed up. So so enter like my sponsor 2.5 years into sobriety. And I'm going through the my second workshop. And I just did my fourth and fifth with him a month ago. And he's got me into 10 and step 10 and 11, you know. And he says to me, Andrew, he says, I want you, because no matter what this guy says, right, like I wake up and I start my day. Instead of the old days, it was Joe Camel here with 4 or 5 Camel light cigarettes in a row and a cup of coffee. thinking how I'm going to screw this person or not, you know what I mean, or get my way, actually, is more that, like, I wasn't a thief or whatever, you know. And, you know, he gets me into reading, like where Step 10 and that part where, you know, where it says, you know, when we go to bed at night, you know, all about doing a proper 10th step. You know, and moreover, starting my morning, you know, by upon awakening, you know, getting my higher power to direct my thinking away from self-pity and dishonest and whatever. You know, he gets me because I got a cement head, and that's why AA works. You know, at first I thought it was like a cult, but for a guy like me whose head is so thick, okay, I got to hear it, things over and over and over. So he gets me to read this before I go to bed at night and read it in the morning, okay? So I'm censored, you know? My mind's on a better plane to start my day and deal with this stuff, you know? And I'm not going to sit here and try and sell anybody here on a higher power. You know, you read through the steps. If you haven't figured that out, then, you know what I mean? Like, that's everybody's own experience, you know? But it says in how it works, you know, that one is God, you know? And I do like how people say, like, good orderly direction or, well, that's what I get in the morning, you know? What I'm looking for it and everything I want to know about life's in that book. You know, I can make it through my day if I feel agitated or whatever. I can ask for that thought or action. Get me out of my head, you know. So I don't know. I don't want to ramble on too much about 10 and 11. You know, I hear people say, oh, I live in 10, 11, and 12, and you know what I mean. Because it's being revealed to me slowly. It's like, I like that expression when someone says, like, a layer of an onion, you know. At first, I started reading Reflections in the morning, you know, and another 24-hour book, and my sponsor had me on my knees saying a third step prayer and a seventh. But now it's all coming together now, you know, where I'm starting to see it more clearly. And I'm sure 10 years from now, I have to keep working my program, it's going to be a lot clearer to me now, because it's like a vision for you. They say it's going to be revealed to me slowly, you know, which it has. But my life's a lot better today. I started my day today instead of coming home on a Sunday morning on my way home at 8:30 in the morning. I ran 10K. I used to smoke 2 packs of cigarettes a day. I used the program to quit smoking early. I don't do drugs anymore. I don't drink. And really, my life's gotten a whole lot better. I feel good most days, you know. And, you know, I don't know what to say much more than that. I'm grateful that I came into... I am a grateful alcoholic, you know. And grateful that I came into the rooms. Because I've got a program that's showing me how to live. You know, I'm learning how to live. So for that, I'm grateful. Thanks.